All right, ladies and gentlemen, I really enjoyed this conversation, so I hope you guys are going to enjoy listening to it. Keith Johnson here on the Big MX Radio Podcast. Before we get to it, we've got to thank our sponsors, Racetech Suspension and Engines. These guys are amazing. Increased plushness, increased bottom resistance, and increased horsepower if you're going to work with them on the engine side of things. Those guys are awesome. Also want to give a huge shout out to Backyard Designs. Big MX 24 saves you 20% off your entire order. So go ahead and absolutely do that. Go on to the Backyard Design USA website and lock that in upon checkout. Honestly, you're going to have so much fun just designing your graphics. So by the time you're done, you're not even going to mind that they're like, I don't know, maybe like $180. Want to give a huge shout out to We Big Moto Co. Their clothing is hilarious and amazing, fits well. I'm wearing one of their hoodies right now. I've had it for a couple of months and you'd think I just got it. You know, when you just, you get a new hoodie and then after a couple of washes, it's no longer a new hoodie. Not the case for this. I don't know what the kind of fabric they use, but I like it. Want to give a huge shout out to Heartbeat Hot Sauce. They're available in Canadian Costco's. I think they're also available on Amazon. I love all the flavors. I highly recommend you guys going and checking that out. WSA, if you call them and order a set of wheels, mention Big MX Radio, you're going to save some money. Same thing with Money Inc. Guts Racing, Big MX 20 saves you 20% off every single one of your orders. Through those guys, if you use the discount code, so I highly recommend using it. All right, guys, that's enough of that. Let's get straight to the podcast. Let's talk some moto with Keith Johnson.
We're in a little bit of a heat wave out here, so, you know, we kind of get these things here and there each year, and, man, it's been like mid-90s and going to be right around 100 today over here. So,
all right, will the Star Boys survive?
Yeah. They're gone. So they came in. They rode Tuesday, Wednesday, and they're out. So I think it was. So it was just Deegan and Bennett and Anstey.
Okay, fair enough. No, yeah. No Romano. Isn't he local? Kind of.
Yeah, I think he's a New York guy. Guy, yeah. So I don't know. I didn't really ask why some of the other guys didn't come, but
maybe they didn't get their their permission slip signed for the field trip.
Yeah, I know. I know Hayden. He even admits he struggles in the sand, so he. Yeah. I think they wanted to come down and get as much riding and testing and. A little bit of encouragement and positiveness going into Southwick.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like I don't know Bennett to be a sand specialist either. Obviously Anstey raced the MXGPs. So he's well adept to that sort of thing, but probably hasn't raced, his race bike and race trim. I just like hats off to a team that, goes on a junket like that during when a lot of other teams are probably, I wouldn't say taking a week off, but maybe a little bit more relaxed schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw people had posted it when it got word out. I didn't say anything about it to anybody. I didn't want the world coming down there and bombarding them, but then it kind of got out. And then I think Deegan's had posted something. So the second day there were some people there and, poor kid just catches so much flack online, from people. How is this fair? And I mean, anybody could have reached out. Anybody.
Yeah,
The track was available, and the only person that reached out to ride was them. So
yeah,
hats off to them
for right? Sure. Like, hey, that's just the way it goes. You want to rent like that? You can track. In fact, I think the Alessis used to do that in 2003, going all the way back to that when Mike was like, they would rent the track the day after the national and have them sort of like leave it so that Mike could ride like rough national tracks and kind of get used to what it might be like. Maybe a little bit more, like maybe a little bit of an extreme example of what we're talking about, but, do you want that part to be in the podcast yet? Or technically I am recording, but, I don't know if you wanted that to be in there.
No, that's fine. That's okay, fine. Cool. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Fair I got, enough. Anything I say, you can put in there.
All right, yeah, no, I was thinking you'd put your foot in your mouth too bad, but I will throw down my intro in a few minutes here, but I think this is going to be a cool conversation because I want to talk about, obviously, what's going on with Keith Johnson now. I want to talk about the fact that you still probably go a whole lot faster than I do on a dirt bike, and the fact that the anniversary of your first professional race is the 36th anniversary of your first professional race is coming up, my friend. Do you know why I know that it's the 36th anniversary?
No, I don't. I had no idea that was coming up or anything. I don't even remember what my first race was. I guess it must have been 88.
That's right, 88 in Southwick, which happens to be about 8 months before I was born. So that's why I remember that it's 36 years, my friend, because I'm going to be on the backside of 35 in just a few months' time. And yeah, May 22nd, 1988. Maybe let's just start there here on the Big MX Radio podcast brought to you by Racetech. First of all, not too many guys break into the professional ranks in the 250 class, but it is the 80s after all. You're on Cowies today, if I'm not mistaken, and looks like you were on a Kawasaki then. Tell me about the 1988 Kawasaki 252 stroke, and the year that led up to you making your first national, at Motocross 338, or otherwise known as the Wick.
Yeah, man, 36 years ago, that's a long time. Starting to feel old. I mean, I feel old anyways, but when you put it that way, it's kind of cool actually to think about. But
you had a long career too, man. Your career spanned 20 goddamn years.
Yeah, I was lucky too at the end of my career too to go to Canada and race up there for a few years in 04, 05, and 06. And I could have gone back up, and then, you know, not to get too far ahead here, I got an offer from Kawasaki to do vet stuff down here at home in the States, you know, like all the big amateur stuff like Loretta's and Minio's and Lake Whitney and things like that. And a good contingency program, which I can kind of get into a little bit later later on and kind of explain that. But I chose to do that instead of traveling so much. And it was just a little bit easier for me. But leading into that 88, you had mentioned not many people go right into the 250 class, but I was, I think because of a close friend, JoJo Keller, when I was younger, JoJo sort of took me under his wing and I would ride with him a lot, at 14, 15 years old. And I first hopped on one of his CR500s, I think when I was 14, just to ride it and immediately loved the big bore power. And when I turned 16, so I was racing, you know, the 250 and 500 A class in Loretta's, at, I guess, 86, 87. So I was 16, 15 and 16 riding the KX500, in Loretta's. So, I was just used to that big bore power. And I'm not a big guy, but I'm not small either. So the 125 was, just harder for me to ride because, you know, I'm 185 pounds, 6 feet
that's
tall.
Big on 125.
So I struggled on the littler bikes because I was just a little bit bigger than some of these guys. And, you know, when you're 185 on a 125 compared to 135, it's a big deal.
Yeah, you know, 50 some of these pounds guys, as well. So, like, you got guys trying to split hairs with the weight of the bike by a pound or two. 50 pounds on the line is going to make a difference no matter what.
Yeah. So I just adapted to the big bikes better, I think. So I just jumped right into that class. I have no idea how that race went. You could tell me how I finished and I won't remember. I don't remember anything about the race, to be honest with you.
Really?
You
know, okay.
National. Yeah. Yeah. I remember the bike. I remember, you know, that 88 KX250 I really liked. And leading into that race, racing New England stuff, NESC, Back then, we were racing four classes a day, or four motos a day, I should say, 20 plus two, no matter what. So, you know, you were racing four, basically racing four 25-minute motos every weekend. So the NESC, the top NESC guys were just in shape. We always were just in shape because we just rode our asses off on the weekends and just beat the hell out of each other. You know, when Dowdy and Doug Henry and Mike Treadwell and LaRusso and everybody, Tony was a little bit younger, than us, but, you know, back in those late 80s, you know, we were just literally beating the hell out of each other every single moto. And, in hindsight, I guess it kind of shaped everybody into the riders that they were, but, it was NESC that doing those four 20 plus twos every weekend that really helped all of us.
Yeah, it certainly is. We should talk about the NESC because it's in my mind, and I think there's a couple of other series in the States that still remain strong, and that there's a great community around it. I think the first one that comes to mind is the RMX series that kind of sprawls between Utah, Nevada, and Idaho. But there's nothing quite like the NESC today or even back then. It's not just the series itself. It's the people around the series. It's the characters that breathe life into the series year after year and want to see it flourish. Like the names that you just mentioned, like for the most part, they're local heroes, but they're almost like American heroes of motocross. They're these guys who continue to line up year after year after year. And like you talked about Tony LaRusso, like him being younger than you. Well, I remember there was a video that came out in 2003, and it basically sort of like chronologized Tony is one of the older guys out there, and I'm pretty sure that you were a few years older and also competing that particular weekend. Like it's incredible to see. I think it's amazing that the guys that have all stayed together and continue to ride. Like I know, like you're still pretty active on a motorcycle. Treadwell, until recently, I think he had a pretty big crash and then he hasn't been riding for a while there, but like he's like, you guys can't get enough of it. Like four 45-minute motos back then, and you guys are still asking for more. That's a testament to just how much the NESC crowd loves motocross. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I agree. I think so NESC, just for whatever reason, just bred some solid riders early on, you know, with guys like Jimmy Ellis, who is the first ever Supercross champion, and then you know, come after that, you got guys like, a lot of people might not remember Mike Guerra, but Mike Guerra was, you know, a unbelievable guy from New England and went on to race in Europe and GPs and won over there. And then local guys that just went so fast, like Jimmy Meenan and Joe Waddington. These would be, you know, Joe would be top five, six, seven at nationals, and same with Meenan. And then JoJo, of course, and John Finkelday, who's still probably the scariest person and nicest person I've ever met to this day. Like the guy shakes your hand and he just feels like he's going to crush you. And he's still like that, you know, at 60 something years old. And it's just, I don't know. We just, like I said earlier, we beat the hell out of each other every weekend. And I don't know. I think it was just the longer motos and, for whatever reason, that NESC has always been such a competitive series and still is. Where, you know, things get spread out as time goes on, more series pop up, and, you know, at any given weekend in New England that you could race in six or seven different places for motocross. Back in the day, you only had NESC or you had NEMA, and NEMA was the mini cycle organization. So it was basically at the time way back was 100cc and down. So that's where all the kids were. And then all the older guys were at NESC. You had no choice. It was one or the other. And now it's a little bit more diluted. You have a lot or I should say a lot more diluted, but you have so many options, but still the numbers are fantastic as far as just a local race. We're getting, Southwick will get 600-700 entries on a local race.
That's awesome.
No problem. Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's still competitive, all the fast guys, Chris Canning recently, switched over to a series we have called J-Day, kind of off-road. It's half off-road and half motocross. They it's like a hybrid series. That series does very, very well. But,
yeah,
Chris, I think was sixth or seventh last year at the Southwick National in the 450 class. So NESC still seems to, breed these guys, that come out, Jimmy D, Jimmy Dakotas, and Robbie Marshall, just local guys that just, I think because of the competition and the long motos, it's a completely different world now, right? Everybody
yeah.
is being homeschooled and living at facilities and training. And, those days of getting by on pure talent is over, I think. So you'll probably see less of that nowadays. Like just you're never going to see another John Dowd story in the history of motocross.
No.
You just won't see it. It won't happen. Nobody starts racing a dirt bike at 21 years old and then starts winning supercrosses and national and becomes
factory
a supercross
ride.
Person.
Like,
right.
Yeah. No, that honestly must have been ridiculous even for you guys. Like, because I got to imagine you're around the same age as John. Like, what was the scene when this guy who he must have started somewhere, like you were probably a lot faster than him before he turned pro. And then like at some point the gap was shortened and you guys were probably like battling quite close, both on nationals and, NESC races.
Yeah. John came on the series, and like I said, what he did, it'll never be repeated in the history of the world. I'll go to my grave saying that because, these kids are groomed from 50 cc's to be supercross champions. And John started, his first race was when he was 21 years old, right? So
of legal
this
age.
Guy went from, right? He went from a novice to an amateur, so a C rider to a B rider to an A rider in one season. And when he came into the A class, everybody was, I couldn't stand him. I hated him. I was like, who is this guy coming in? It was at the beginning of the season, he was a C rider. Now he's up contesting for wins. And like nobody's going to like that guy.
No,
right?
No.
So, that first couple of years, Dowdy, like we knew of him and, we weren't really friendly with him. And honestly, it was aggravating to me that this guy comes in and starts beating us, in his second year racing. And, fast forward all these years and we're like best friends now, right?
So yeah, no kidding. You guys must have talked about a thousand times, like, oh, I totally hated you when you did this. And he's like, oh, I hated you when you did that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, we talk about that a lot of times, so. Mm-hmm. In 88 is when, I lived in Florida for the winter series in 88 with Dowdy and Tread. And that was the first time I really, that's when I really got to know John. We became great friends after that and one of my best friends these days. So, 87, I think 86 was his first year racing or end of 85. And then, by 88, he was finishing top 10 in the nationals, right? So, right in there somewhere. So, he was a freak of motocross, that's for sure. But we talk about that a lot, about just how hard we could race each other. I mean, I have scars on my body, legit scars from Treadwell in a couple different spots.
Yeah.
Where he drew blood and I had to get stitches. But he was the best man at my wedding, right? So
there you go.
We could race each other hard, knock each other down, and draw blood, and still be best friends. That was one of the cool parts about New England racing. Same with Doug Henry. That guy, you'd race him so hard, and he would race you so hard, and knock him down. He'd knock you down, whatever, and he'd come off with the biggest smile on his face. Like, it was the best thing in the world.
Well, I don't know if any of you guys own a pair of blades, but the way you guys love motocross reminds me of how me and my Canadian friends love hockey. Because, yeah. Like, I grew up, I was born in 88. I played competitive hockey until about 2006 or 7, right up until when you start to wear visors. And if you cross-check my buddy, I'm going to talk to you about it. But I've literally gone for beers with somebody who knocked out my front teeth, like, yeah. 2 hours earlier. Like, I need dental surgery later this week, but we're going to go to the, like, there was a bar at the end, like, there was a bar right next to the arena, and both teams would go there, and there was a couple of fights afterwards, but for the most part, there wasn't. It's just that competitiveness of, like, hey, like, yeah, like, you did that to me, I did that to you, that's hockey, or that's racing. And we can talk about it. Like, I think there's something powerful within that and just being able to sort of like kind of squash that and realize that that's one side of life and this is a different side of life.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it, increases your level of play, right? I think, you know, you're racing or riding or playing hockey with some of your best buddies and you don't want to be beat by your buddies, right?
No.
So, but at the same time, you'll kill them to beat them, right? And then go have a beer after. So
that's right.
I love it. I think it's great.
That is unreal. So your involvement with Motocross 3.8, DeWick, has been well documented. And I think it's got to be a big point of pride for you to be able to kind of give back to that and kind of see it continue to flourish. Maybe you can give the listeners who don't know exactly what the situation is with you and the track. How does that all go about? And what type of just honestly pure joy that you get in being able to continue to see that place develop and work on it as long as the rain isn't taking away half your sand.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a love-hate relationship sometimes. So the WIC 338 is basically owned by the American Legion, Legion 338. It's on their land, always
okay.
has been. They own the land, and they lease the land to the track. So, basically, there was, Bernie Yellen, had come in and started that. He had worked out the arrangements with the Legion, way back in the '70s. And, he ran the track all the way into, I don't know exactly when, but early 2000s, right in there somewhere, probably. Another couple that was helping Bernie at the track took it over from there, Ralph and Diane. Some things happened between Ralph and Diane and the Legion. They didn't see eye to eye on some things, and they shut the track down. And the track sat empty for 2 years, I think, 13 and 14.
Yeah.
With no
It's
no
weird
event.
To not have it on the series.
Yeah, nothing going on, no local races. There was grass growing everywhere. It went to nothing. And then Mike Grondel, the dad of Eric Grondel, who's a avid New England motocross guy and well-known in the motocross industry, went to the Legion and sort of resurrected the lease, basically.
Really?
And
I did not know
that.
Yeah,
yep. So Mike went in and
everyone got Planet Fitness memberships.
Yeah. So Mike had so much going on and he was looking for someone to basically run it, take over the lease. And you know, he just wanted to see, because he grew up in New England. He was a New England racer, was a great racer. And he wanted to see Southwick back to what it was and to its glory, basically. But obviously he had no desire in running it, just wanted it, to have somebody to that he could trust that, would do it. So he had called me, because I knew Mike, pretty well because he had done a small little, team to help promote, the Planet Fitness thing at the beginning with myself and Mike Treadwell. So we traveled around with his son, Eric, and helped him for a couple of years. And so I got to know Mike and the family pretty well. And so Mike had called and said, hey, do you want to run Southwick? And at the time I was just it wasn't, I didn't really want to do it. And I did, but I just didn't think I had the time for it. And because I was just getting into opening a fitness center, and I said no. And then, some time went by, or a few days, and he called again, and we talked some more about it. And it sat with me for a little bit. And finally, I was like, you know what, I want to make sure this is done right. I know that I think I can do it. And so anyways, I took it over, I've had it since then, since 2015. So, we did some local races that first year, and then we spoke with Davey Coombs at MX Sports about, possibly getting the national back. He came out with him and his team, and, said, all right, this is what we'd like to see for changes. This is what's changed in the series, and a lot of infrastructure changes had to be made. So little by little, we just keep picking away at it, and the facility and infrastructure, everything just gets better and better and better as we go. So, here we are, I guess, almost 10 years later now, and going strong.
Absolutely. It's a hallmark of the series. It's the only sand track on the series. And it's funny I feel like the internet has a funny way of doing this where, back in the day, or back when I started getting into motocross in the early 2000s, it was widely considered to be like the Southwick as being on this gnarly sand track. And then this narrative started that it's not as sandy as you thought it was. It's actually got a really hard base. It's like that maybe it's not the sand track that everyone thinks that it is. What's the current state of the track? As far as like the sandiness of it, is it different than it was when you first rolled out onto the track? I know it's gone probably at least two different directions over the years. As far as the where the sand is between 88 and now, maybe get into that a little bit and kind of just set the record straight as to the current state of affairs over at the WIC.
Yeah. So. The WIC is sort of, nothing is flat there. It's all hills. So everything right. runs from the top of the track down by the starting line. And we have catch ponds that catch a lot of the sand, but a lot of it ends up basically in the woods out behind the starting line. So, or beside the starting line. So I'm constantly bringing in sand, truckloads of sand, and replacing. And people always ask, why are you bringing sand to a sand track? Because it legit, it does go away. And it's not that it goes away to the point that there's no more sand, but the track just sinks, so the banks on the side get higher. So I like to keep the levels of the track up. But, the biggest difference, Brad, really is the irrigation system. So back in the day, they were watering that track with garden hoses. And then they put a better system in there, and then they had
bigger
inch and a half
hose.
Fire hoses. Yeah. So nowadays it is, one of the things that, we have bullet points on things that are important for the national, and basically because of how TV is so important and the look of the series and everything, the track needs to be moist enough that it doesn't have dust, and not wet enough that the dirt sticks to the front number plate. So they don't want the dirt sticking to the front number plate, but they don't want dust.
That was my favorite thing about Southwick, though, is you couldn't read anyone's numbers. That was like death taxes, and everyone's front number plate is completely caked. Come on.
Right. So our race is typically end of June, early July in the sand. So it's super difficult to get that, just the right amount of moisture so it's constantly irrigating. So sprinklers pop up and this thing. So if you just let that thing irrigate and it just, the water keeps running and it just kind of packs the sand down. So now we rip it, it sounds funny, but ripping the sand track, we bring out the tiller get it all fluffed up again, because the water will just keep it all packed down. Back in the day, if you look at YouTube videos of Southwick National, there's dust and super soft berms, and it was so soft because they just couldn't, they didn't have the water capacity to keep the dust down. So it just became moon dust. So, yeah, it was a lot softer back then because of that. But today standards, we could never have a national with dust like that. Right.
Right. So right. Right.
It's important that, it's right. So that is honestly the main reason, but we're constantly bringing in sand and fluffing it up and ripping it and trying to keep the integrity of the track and have really being the only sand track on the circuit. So we do the best we can with it.
Absolutely. I think that it's important to have a sand track on the series because that is a skill set that not everybody has. You'd mentioned that even the great Danger Boy Deegan struggles with that. And I think that there's a lot of people, including myself, who do as well. Like, for you, what is the, like, if you could, in as like short synopsis as possible, what is the key to going fast in the sand, especially at the Wick?
Well, it is. It first, I think it just comes down to brute force and ignorance. Meaning,
I was going to go there.
Yeah, you can't search for smooth lines and expect to set fast lap times. You just have to go through the rough stuff. The rough line is going to be the fastest line typically. So you have to just learn how to ride the rough and the rollers. So. I've seen a lot of people ride around that place, and you know, from back in my day to current day, right? So,
yeah.
One of the best, and we see it all the time. But I'm telling you, the best guy I've ever seen ride that place is Jet. It is
really
absolutely, yeah. It is absolutely poetic watching him. He makes a rough sand track look like it's smooth, and there's just no laboring involved. Even, you know, Tomac's one of my favorite guys. I love watching him ride. I love watching him race. Love watching him win. And he rides around that track. You can feel his bike coming by. You don't even have to know it's him. You can just feel it moving the ground when he comes by. And Jet, it's like he's just floating around the track. It's something to watch. And when you have a track and you've seen that so many people ride around it, good riders. And if you like little subtle things, but when you're watching the difference between Jet and whoever's in second and third, he's making them look like B riders sometimes. It's very impressive, very impressive. But I think, to get around in the sand, you can't fight it. You need to typically, you know, you're up a gear, you're not on the rev limiter, and you're riding those rough lines.
Yeah, no, I think if I think of the guys I know well who just go good there is a guy like Jimmy D. He was obviously up here in Canada a fair bit. He married a local up to where I'm from. And just meeting Jimmy, like, like Southwick separates the men from the boys. And what I mean by that is like that there's guys who talk the talk and there's guys who walk the walk that when things go sideways or when things get tough, they leave the throttle on. And he's one of those people. And I think any of the guys who have sort of become legends around the track itself, Southwick, they all have that commonality, whether it's yourself, John Dowd, Doug Henry, Chris Canning. Like when it comes to like, are you going to shut off when the bike gets a little swap sideways, or are you going to bulldog your way through things? They all like sign up for that. And, I think it's completely genuine the way they do it. It's impressive to see. And, yeah, I absolutely love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if you look at, you know, the European guys, they typically have more sand tracks on the circuit. So, you know, you take, and especially if you're from Holland, right? So you look at Herling's probably the best sand rider in his prime in the world. Right. And yeah, it's just so smooth, and you don't see him searching for smooth lines. He just hits the rough lines and he hits them fast. And there's definitely a talent to it that some people don't have. And our local guys seem to. I mean, Southwick's famous for some guy showing up with duct tape on his bike and running in the top 10 at a national, right? Nobody knows who the hell he is. And even John Dowd, 1 year he got third at the Southwick National. The very next week, he said he rode his ass off at Mount Morris and went like 25, 27 or something like that. So,
oh, yeah. That's a special place. Yeah. So we talked about the 88 Southwick. That was your first. Let's talk about your last. You're getting on in age. You're riding KTMs, which we could talk. I could go a thousand different directions with you on a podcast, which means that you're probably going to end up having to be a repeat offender. Because we haven't even scratched at Cannondale or anything quite like that. But you're on a KTM. It's 2003. Are you a 252 stroke or are you on a 4-stroke here?
So that year, I was on a 4-stroke, okay, with Dowdy, like a KTM satellite team. Through
okay,
Jeff
is that
Cernick.
What that was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So
those are good bikes.
Cernick,
you guys are getting starts all the time.
Yes. So it was 2 and 3.
Yep.
We did that team, and 2, we were on those KTM 520s. Those things were absolute
tractors.
And yeah, Guy Cooper raced that year.
Yep.
He came back and raced. He was actually on a 540.
Yeah.
So he got a ton of hole shots. And then we went to, I think it was 2003 that KTM came out with their 450. Mm-hmm. And Dowdy stuck to the 2-stroke 250.
Mm-hmm.
And I was riding the 450. And then I had so many DNFs that year because the bike just kept breaking. Weird things. It was KTM's first year, I think, with the 450.
Yeah.
And it was just a horrible year for me luck-wise. I remember them saying, okay, let's just put you on a 252 stroke because the bike just isn't finishing. It's breaking all the time. It's not finishing. We can't keep it together. Stupid luck and – So I went to Unadilla on a 252 stroke, and John and I still laugh about this, but I went to Unadilla. Well, at least we'll finish motos. You might not have ridden a 2-stroke in years, but at least you'll finish motos. And I went out in the first moto and caught a rock in my rear sprocket and folded the thing right over, so I couldn't even ride it. It had to get towed back to the pits, you know. So it was like that was pretty much my year summed up in one race, just – one thing after another, stupid things just kept happening. I don't remember if it was that year or the year before. I caught a rock right in the forehead from Kyle Lewis. Just literally knocked me out for a lap. I was riding my bike, and it was the first lap of a race. And all of a sudden, I'm riding. I just kind of woke up. I'm like, why am I sweating so bad on the first lap? And I don't remember any of the lap. It was like the whole lap had gone by. And I
autopilot.
Kind of woke up on my bike thinking, like, why am I sweating so bad? It's the first lap. And then I kept going. And I looked down, and my bike was just covered in blood. My forehead was split open with a rock. And that was pretty much my season summed up. It was horrible.
No doubt. Well, do you have a brother named Dana?
I have a cousin. Named
cousin.
Dana.
I was going to say, I'm like, there's another, there's three Johnsons in this race. Two of them with the first name, same first name, but there's another Johnson from, Pembroke. So, I would imagine that's got to be kin to you.
Yes. Yeah. Dana's, my younger cousin. He was, he's like a brother to me. He's,
okay.
He was, a good, New England rider, you know, a top 10 to 5 NESC guy. And, rode some nationals, qualified, here and there for some nationals. And,
That is awesome.
Yeah, so he's got probably a few stats in there.
Yeah, he does. And like, so, and like, we can't get too far into this without talking about the fact that, I showed you some pictures from 2006, not realizing that they were actually, these two posters, I assume they were different years, but no, they're the same year, just and two different guys, same name. He's quite a few years younger than you, if I'm not mistaken, but Keith R. Johnson from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then there's Keith S. Johnson, from Massachusetts. I imagine there's a fair bit of confusion between the two of you, especially considering the fact you both raced the same class more than a few years.
Yeah, for sure. There's always confusion. I think even some of the vault stuff has us confused here and there.
Okay.
So there's definitely some confusion there. When we raced in Canada that year, I think, like you said, it was 06. So I was on the Suzuki team, and then he was riding for the Yamaha Morgan team. And there was some confusion there for sure. It was fun sometimes, but it was a lot of confusion for some years.
No kidding. Well, I hope you guys took each other out for a beer about at some point. Just then, Keith Johnson picked up the tab. What do you remember about the 03 that Southwick though? You end up. I'm sure that Ezra Lusk wanted nothing to do with you all day long. It was his last year on Factory Cowie. That bike was notoriously bad. And he's just probably like, this guy from Massachusetts is just sweating me right now, mid-moto. I want nothing of it.
I don't remember anything about it. How
Perfect.
Did I do?
You ended up going 12-13 aboard your KTM, just behind Ezra and just ahead of David Villeman, who went 18-8.
Okay.
It was, honestly, maybe not your best Southwick. In fact, your best Southwick was 2 years prior in the 125 class. Fourth overall. That's got to stick out in your mind as something that is pretty special to you.
Yeah, for sure. So we talk about that. We do some camps here at Southwick, Chris Canning and myself. And,
right.
And with the younger kids and guys coming up, and I tell people all the time, so that 01 season, I had some good finishes. So I was coming off of a couple of years with Cannondale. I hadn't really raced competitively because that thing wouldn't finish. And then I got on a Yamaha satellite team to race, or a privateer team, I should say, with Bill Dill to race in 01, the 250F. So I had trained to get ready for that 01 season and went to Glen Helen. Yeah, I had some good finishes. I had no idea what to expect. It was a stacked class, that 125 class. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know if I was going to qualify, if I was going to be in the top 10, 20. I had no idea. So I know I was doing a lot of riding with Dowdy and Doug, and we were training a lot and, just felt ready. And then I went to Glen Helen and ended up fifth there in the first round, and had some good races, some bad races. And Southwick, third one moto, I don't know what the finishes were, 3-6 or 3-7 for fourth or something, I don't know. But
3-7 for fourth. That third's got to be cool, 3-7. Though, like behind Mike Brown, Travis Pastrana, and then there's Keith Johnson.
Yeah, so... And I tell people all the time, I was not, like the kids coming up, I wasn't the third fastest guy or the fourth fastest guy that day. But I was in shape and I had sort of picked my way through, and I've watched that race a couple of times, since then. And I that moto that I got third, it was just, I just outlasted a lot of the guys. Like there were guys that were coming up, I can't remember, Sellards or Fonseca. And they were faster, but just didn't last the 30 minutes. And I can't remember exactly who it was, but, I finished third basically because I outlasted them, not because I was the third fastest guy. And I tell people this all the time, that the best thing you can do is to make sure that your body is good. You know, the one thing that I always hated was going and getting – I can handle getting beat because someone's better than me. I can't handle getting beat because I got tired. That drives me nuts. Right. To the point where I went back to Loretta's a few years ago and raced Emig, and I could handle getting beat by Emig, right? If he beat me because he was better. But if he beat me because I got tired, that would just aggravate me. Right. So, even to this day, I hate getting feet because, you know, I'm 53 years old and, you know, got a little pumped up. I hate that. It drives me nuts. But, you know, it's one thing that you can control is being in shape and ready for your race.
No doubt. You've always been in shape. You've been sort of a proponent of physical activity and being living with wellness as much as you can. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're still able to do the vintage stuff that you do. I know you're going over to Farley Castle later on this year. You seem to always be active and doing stuff like that. I think it's pretty encouraging. And it honestly, as a 35-year-old, I'm like, pfft, I can do this for another 25 years easy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. And again, I say it a lot, but I think as you get older, you need to keep moving. And, once you stop the train, it's hard to get it rolling again. So, you just got to keep doing something. And, that race that I do a couple of them over there, Farley Castle and Fox Hill. And, those are fun races. They keep the fire going with inside me, you know, it gives me something fun to do. Last year, you know, I'm racing in the 50 plus class with, guys like Alessio Chiodi, who's a 2 or 3 time world champion. And,
does he still have the Carlton. Dreads?
Yes. Yeah, he does.
He does. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I raced him. I remember we talked on the starting line a little bit and, you know, he said, I come to Southwick one time and, he said, I go to the hospital right away. No fun. Yeah, I guess he got hurt the one time he came over to Southwick.
Yeah.
So.
That's wild. Yeah. No, like, yeah, like those events are cool. Have you ever, like, has anyone ever rolled a Cannondale up to you and said, hey, can you spin a lap on this thing? And you're like, get that thing away from me. Or like that, like,
you know,
there's some rare bikes over there, but I haven't seen a Cannondale.
Yeah, I have not seen a Cannondale over there. I've seen a lot of bikes, and I've ridden a lot of bikes. Their vintage scene over there is it's absolutely mind-boggling. The Fox Hills race that I do over there, when I tell you that it is close to the size of the Southwick National, I'm not exaggerating.
It's, oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's unbelievable how many people they get through the gates over there. So. You know, I think they said that it was like 15 or 16,000 people through the gate at Fox Hill. And then a month later at MXGP, you know, 45 minutes down the road, they had 9 or 10,000 people through the gate. So,
it's
unbelievable the presence that they have over there and the scene. But the vintage stuff is alive and well over there for sure. But yeah, that feeds my fire. It's a great race.
Do they prep a KX500 for you? I'd imagine that, like, I think, to me, you're a Kawasaki guy. Like, that seems to be, would be right up your alley. What kind of bikes have you ridden while you're over there?
Yeah, so I've ridden, mostly a KX500. So I have some friends over there that, build the bike, they have their bikes, and, I rode them over there. One year I rode a YZ250 that Doc Waugh built. I was with Brownie and Doug Dubach. I can't remember who else was there that year. But each race is a little bit different. Farley is more vintage bike. So, and the format is different. It's a four-man team. And one person on the team has to ride a twin shock bike. So,
So last year we went. Didn't Todd DeHoop ride the twin shock the one year?
Yeah, Todd, I think, rode one year. Dowdy did that year, that race a lot for years. So did Todd, I think. Last year, myself and Tim Ferry, was Brock Tickle last year or year before? Another guy, Cody Williams here from New England, came over. And so I was the twin shock guy. So I rode a, I think it's an 82 Husqvarna 450 two-stroke twin shock with drum brakes, the whole nine yards. And the bike is actually super fun to ride. It just stinks when you're having to race it with more modern bikes. So most of the guys are on like 90, 91, 92, 93s, things like that. And then when you're on an 82 twin shock with drum brakes, racing with those other bikes, it makes it a little harder. So the format, I wasn't a huge fan of that. Like if you were racing just twin shocks, it would be cool. But everybody races in the same moto together. So, you know, one guy on the team has to be on a twin shock. So it's, you can't stop like they can. But either way you slice it, it's a 450cc two-stroke. So the thing's fast, but it just doesn't stop and it doesn't turn. So it takes a little bit of getting used to. And you don't, like, who has one of those to practice on, right?
So yeah, never, exactly. You're not, the prep on that would be a little bit difficult.
Yeah, yeah. So you just show up and hop on the thing and go out for practice, and then, you know, you got 10 minutes on it, and then you go race. So, but it's fun. Super laid back. Everybody's great over there. The atmosphere is cool. The fans are great. And it's cool to, you know, be in another country.
No doubt. Like, so are you going over there again this year? And have you officially put to bed going back to Loretta's, or are you gonna run it back at some point?
Yeah, I never say never. I feel like I'm done probably with Loretta's, but I would never say never. It's just, like I said, for me, it's the grind. I hate getting beat because I got tired. So I, like, that year, the last year I went to Loretta's, I found myself in the middle of July, you know, just grinding out motos in the heat when I wanted to be at the pool with my family or, you know, doing fun stuff. And here I am riding and training on days that I don't really want to.
Right.
And it kind of took the fun out of it for me. Again, I'll be 54 soon. So it, you know, I like doing the fun races. I can enjoy it a little bit more. Loretta's is not just that 1 week, but it's the 2-3 months leading up to it grind that wears on me.
Fair enough. So, like, take me through, if you could. I'm sure there was some, at some point when, like, if you showed up to an NESC race, you're at least going to be tops, if not the like top two every single weekend. Tell me a little bit about sort of the trading of the baton, because there had to have been at some point when you didn't quite have the same speed as the Chris Cannings or the Robbie Marshalls of the world. What was that transition like for you?
I don't know. I'm still going through it. I hate it. Like, I hate the transition. Like, I'm not even close to like a Canning or a Kilkino, so I'm not even close to their speed, but it still bugs me. It's one of the things I think that's hard as a racer. I know Tony La Russa feels the same way. He's still racing and going fast, and you just have that whatever it is inside you that just feels like you should be doing better than you're doing, and you just can't, and it's aggravating. So you end up accepting it, but I don't think you ever really get over it. I don't know. It's not like I was this big superstar racer, like a McGrath or an Emig or somebody like that, but I don't know. There's something inside that you just hate getting beat no matter who it is. Maybe that makes it the fun part of it, but yeah, I mean, around, so when I came back from Canada, '06, but I was 36 years old at that point.
My age, by the way.
Yeah. So, it was right around then, you know, that it was becoming more difficult for me to win and beat these guys. And, it's always a hard pill to swallow. Still is. And for whatever reason, it sounds funny, but, I think that's part of the fire that's inside.
Absolutely. That continues to burn. So when the Nationals come to Southwick in just over 6 days time, who's the local from the NESC who's going to fly the flag, probably either the proudest or at least, probably turn the most amount of heads, of the kids that are, kind of like Massachusetts, like Northeast locals that are gonna upset some people probably watching like either playing fantasy motocross or just maybe a name that we haven't heard before or not we don't hear very often.
So I would say first in the 450 class would be Justin Kokinos. He had a rough crash last year at Southwick, coincidentally, but that put him off the bike pretty much the entire season. He was getting ready for, it was just about a year ago that happened, I think. So But it kept him off the bike the entire year. He had some major internal injuries, blew his spleen to pieces, and they had to take out, some other organ. They took out his pancreas, I think, yeah. And but he's coming back to form now, and so he'll be one to watch for sure. He should be inside the top 20. In that 450 class, and the 250 class, I'm not so sure. There's some younger kids that went to Mount Morris that qualified really well from New England. To be honest, I don't really know those kids well. Ashton Aruda and Jesse Wessel, they don't really race New England much. They're you know, like we had talked about earlier, they're like more down in facilities and stuff now. So, I think watching out for them, they'd be pretty good in the 250 class. So, yeah, there's nobody that really stands out like Jimmy did last year. Jimmy D shows up out of the blue and sets the fastest qualifying time.
He was on a mission
to do that. Yeah, it was awesome.
No doubt, speaking of NESC, if it's not Southwick, which I think it is Southwick, what is a track within the NESC series that people need to know about, or they need to put on their list of tracks to ride that kind of gets overshadowed by, of course, the WIC?
Yeah, so we have a lot of cool tracks. A new one popped up. It's called 508, because of the area code. Mm-hmm. More of a hard pack track. They're new on the series this year. Great people over there. It's a fun track, really fun track, exact opposite of Southwick. So instead of whooped out sand, it's a lot more hard packed, ruts, choppy. That's a fun track. All the tracks are pretty good. Crow Hill is really good, and Tony LaRusso runs, he owns New Hampshire MX up there. It's the old Jolly Rogers in New Hampshire is a good track. And Winchester in New Hampshire has a good track. They're all really good, they're unique in their own way for sure. I love seeing like the 508 track come into the series, because I think any time that we, can gain a track, you always hear of places, closing down, right, and losing places to ride. So it was kind of cool to see them come in and get a couple of races on the schedule.
Fair enough. I like it. Honestly, I would love to come down and do an NESC race, whether it's at Southwick or one of those other ones. I think the culture around the series is so unique, and it's a little bit old school compared to a lot of the other series that have sort of gotten broken up, or there's not as many series anymore, as there's just like separate events that sort of happen throughout the year. They're not really connected in any way. That's just like where these kids race, and they do the regionals and their areas and whatnot. There's nothing quite like the NESC. I hope you guys keep it going for quite some time.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate that. It's a great series. I mean, I think that they're it's over 50 years now that it's been, well over 50. It's 50s in the 50s season. So it's impressive. And the president of NESC, Dave Clemens, who's in his 70s, factory bull taco rider back in the day, still races to this day. So I think it's because of guys like David that, keep that NESC spirit and series alive. And, it's always, it's cool to see the numbers that they get, and I'm glad that it's still thriving.
No doubt. So one thing I actually wanted to mention, I'm noticing on your Instagram, is that there's been some scammers selling tickets to Moto 338. What the hell?
Yeah. That's, it's not just us. It's, all the nationals. So, huh. You know how it is. We live in a world now where your whole identity can be stolen and all these different, there's scams everywhere for everything. And they're finding a way now to sell tickets. I got a message from somebody this week on Facebook saying, is it true that you might sell out of tickets and you can't get them at the front gate? You know, so they put out there, like, listen, you got to buy tickets now or you might not be able to get them because once they're gone, they're gone.
And yeah.
That's not true. You can
forcing
always get
a little
them
bit of urgency.
Gate.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I know Redbud had some issues with it too in Unadilla. So it's frustrating, you know. So we just do the best we can to inform everybody that just go to a reputable website with that link, right? So the WIC website or MX Sports website, those two, you can't go wrong.
Okay, fair enough. So go to those two websites and get your tickets for the WIC. Where is the best place to watch from? If I'm a fan and I just want to find one spot on the track to be able to see either the best obstacle or the best viewing point, in your mind, where is the best spot to post up and watch Southwick?
Yeah, so Southwick is kind of cool because you can see a lot of the track from most places. So we have a place that's called Preferred Island Viewing. So it's literally, you got to take a tunnel underneath the track to get to what is like an island in the middle of the track. And if you're in that island, you can see 75% of the track at all times. So that's a really cool spot to watch. We have a few VIP sections that we do and that we built, and where we built them, it didn't take away from any of the general admission tickets and viewing. We added these sections that were, we had taken down a bunch of trees and built these platforms in such a way that it didn't take away from any of the general admission tickets. So those VIPs are strategically located, so you can always have a good view from any of those. Those sell out fast, though. They've been gone for months. But personally, I think that island viewing is probably one of the best.
Awesome, man. Last question I have for you here on the Big MX Radio podcast. Like I said, we could probably go for a couple of hours, and I'm not even going to dig into the Cannondale talk because you're going to have to be a repeat offender here on the podcast. We'll give you a few months off, give your voice a little bit of a break, and we'll bring you back on. Last question I have for you, though, is if you could bring back and basically back in race trim one of your race bikes from your career and have it, whether it's in the garage, just shining up and looking good, or to spin some laps on every once in a while, what bike would that be and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. So it might be like a two-parter here, but
that's fine.
So the bike that is really near and dear to me is the 1987 KX500. And the reason is that is the bike that I won my first expert moto on in New England. So I came in, turned expert in 86. Went to an A rider in 86, and then in 87 is when I on the 500, because I just, for whatever reason, just like the power of the bigger bikes. And so my first moto win, I always did well on the 500. So I have a connection to that KX500, that 87 KX500. But having said that, I have done that. So I have, well, it's not an 87, but it's a 1990 KX500 that I've redone pretty well. But if I was going to redo another one on a bike that I liked, that I actually raced, I think the 98 KX250, I really liked that bike. It was something about the way it handled and just felt for me. The 97 and 98, I really liked both those bikes. They were just great for me.
Was Carson Brown not racing or riding one of those like a week ago?
You know, I don't know.
I think it was.
I see his videos. Yeah, was he?
I think so. Yeah, they built it up. It looks sweet too. That, like, I'm a Kawasaki guy. Grew up on Cowies. The last one I need to add to the collection is a 500. I've got the 85, the 125, the 252 stroke. I need a 500. But yeah, I think he was spinning some laps. I'll send you the video on Instagram here. He was putting a that era, like the 97 and 98 were the same plastics. And it's one of those. And he was racing. He was riding a 250.
Oh yeah, that's cool. I'll have to check it out. I loved it. I just something about the bike that those both those years I just really clicked with. What do you have for what years are yours?
I've got my 01 85. My dad is one of the most nostalgic people you'll ever meet. So he sold his 78 and 75 RMs back in the day. I bought him his 78 back. I'll send you a picture of it. It's absolutely pristine. He hasn't started it since I gave it to him. But I have a 2001 KX85, a 2004 KX125, and a 2005 KX250. Those are prized possessions. I would be living in a box and still have those things. I wouldn't sell them.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I'm actually just about done. I'll send you some pictures too, but just about done with an 02 KX250 that I like really spent way too much time and money on than I should have. But
I want that era 250 as well. Cause like to me, that bike, that's the Ricky Carmichael bike, the 02, or actually it was 01, 01 Kawasaki, the Chevy truck shroud and the whole nine yards. Like that was, I don't know, to me, that's a KX250 to me.
Yeah. So I love like the nostalgia of the older bikes and the look and everything. And I have a couple. So I have an 01 125 in stock form. My KX500 is basically in stock form, looks like a normal KX500. But this 02 that I did, because it's like a hybrid, right? So it's an 02,
right.
But it is, so I powder coated the frame. I did it a little bit different. So I powder coated the frame black, but then I have KYB modern forks on it.
Okay. So then it's got the modern front, does it have the modern front fork on it or the modern front number plate and all that?
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. I did one of those, TX race, restyle kits.
Okay.
And usually I'm not a fan of that stuff, like, because I like the bikes to stay in their original form, but,
right.
Because literally nothing on this bike was original,
Really,
there was so much aftermarket stuff and everything was just, just different, right? Wheels and suspension and everything. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try one of these, things. So it makes it look like basically a 2020, KX450, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. But so I don't have the graphics on it yet, but I have the Chevy trucks, like basically design, same thing as Carmichael used.
Uh-huh.
So it thing's pretty badass.
That's pretty badass. I need to see that thing do, more than a lap or two around Southwick. But that's awesome. Yeah, we'll swap some pictures here in a moment here. But Keith, this was fun. Like I said, I need to make you a repeat offender. I know you got to get to the rest of your busy day, and I do as well. But this has been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed chatting with you this morning.
Yeah, same, Brad. It was cool going down some of those memories. Like I said, it's I don't know a lot of that stuff. You could tell me how I did my first race, last race, and it's kind of cool to hear, and then to hear that it was 36 years ago was my first race. I don't know any of that stuff. So it's definitely cool. I'm glad you called, and call anytime. I'd love to chat and reminisce about the old days.
Love it, my friend. Well, you have yourself a great rest of your day. Do not hang up just yet. But for podcast sake, we're going to cut things off right there.
Welcome to Best 42 in the land. All ages from kids up to grown men. Walk through the gates of the coal miner's daughter to make a point clearer than the creek water. Who's the best? Who's it gonna be? In Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Can you feel the adrenaline? Dirt flies hypnotized by the wind spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Times this one week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do for 20 plus 2 out at the ranch. bikes and rowdy fans. Play the national anthem and everybody stands. Smell the smoke from the two strokes riding by. The 30-second card's on its side. Hear the tires by the wheel spin. Hear the crowd, everybody's whistling. Line on the field. If you can put it all together three times, this 1 week of racing could change your life. Everybody knows this is where it all begins. Do what you gotta do for 20 plus 2.